This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Art is Cortina Janelle Caldwell's response to inequity and invisibility. It's been part of her life since she was a child. She once dreamed of becoming an architect and loved to lose herself in books. But then her life had a few detours. Grew up in Morganton, North Carolina, where family and community members supported her and encouraged her to dream big, but also be practical. So she studied nursing for a few years and then realized that wasn't what she wanted. After years of self-discovery and healing, she found Artist Designing Evolution in Asheville. Her organization uses art and creativity to tackle big problems like racism and oppression. Cortina Janelle Caldwell joins me now. Cortina, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you. I want to start with Artist Designing Evolution. It's using art to tackle big problems. What does that look like?
Well, I think that the reality is that at some point, when one is Black, Indigenous, or a person of color, you recognize and experience that you move through the world in a different way, or at least that you're getting a different version of the world. And I think that it has been a burden for a long time. It has been, you know, a source of trauma in some ways for myself and my community. And I think that because of my background, as you mentioned, not only in pre-nursing but also in social work, I was exposed at a pretty early age to this idea of a strength-based approach. And those that are social workers will know what I'm speaking of. But it's this notion that if you are to make any change in an individual or a family or a community's life, that a more impactful, sustainable way to do that is by taking an inventory of strengths and zooming in on strengths as opposed to deficits. And so for a day project and with that work, it really became about how do I really actualize equity using my lived experience and those that I'm in relationship with in community around these similar experiences that we do have involving racism or, you know, any sort of discrimination or injustice on the basis of identity. And a lot of those roots do trace back to racism as we're seeing and experiencing and having a lot of conversations around today. So I think what I would say as far as what does that work look like, it looks like changing mindset about how we can actually impact our communities and shape our realities by really understanding that we do have these amazing strengths of resilience and creativity and cooperation and things that we just inherently have had to do to navigate white supremacy. And so it really becomes about how do we leverage those as assets and really work together to support what we feel is a more just and inclusive community and way of going about our lives.
That opens up a lot of interesting possibilities. And of course, we said I introduced you as the co-founder or the founder of Artist Designing Evolution, which you refer to as ADE. The ADE project is an art-based project that's meant to address questions of social inequity, which we think of, in terms of political activism. So this idea that opening up your creativity, opening up minds to changing minds, which again, one associates with political activity, how much of this is sort of helping artists and activists and the people who come together? Maybe you should talk about the kinds, because you're not just asking artists to be part of this. It's a cooperative that includes lots of different kinds of people to get them to open themselves to their own creativity. Am I right about that?
Yeah, you are absolutely correct. And I think one thing that I have to name here is that we are very intentionally not a 501c3. We have the blessing of a fiscal sponsor here locally, Bountiful Cities, which does amazing work around food justice and social justice and just working to engage folks in taking ownership of their lives. And food is a great place for that work to start. And so we're really honored to have had their support from day one. The other thing with having a fiscal sponsor and not being a 501c3 is that as many cooperatives get their start, especially in the state of North Carolina, we don't have certain legal statuses that other states have, like California, where you can actually be legally deemed as a benefit corporation, you know, and there's just a different way that you're taxed or not, and that your work is classified. Since we don't have that classification here in North Carolina, I intentionally started Artist Designing Evolution as an LLC, and the, you know, it's a single member LLC at this moment, but as we grow, we will be adding additional cooperative members, and we are working with the U.S. Federation of Worker-Owned Cooperatives in order to make sure that we're continuing to cross our T's and dot our I's. But one of the beautiful things that's happened in this process is recognizing how much unlearning we truly have to do about the ways that we've been used to competing and working together. But then also, what does it actually look like to be in a cooperative where my input is my output, and, you know, there's this decentralized, non-hierarchical structure of decision-making. And so that education and that awareness has really become a big part of the work, which was unexpected, because Ade Project, you know, our mission is to actualize equity, spark creative inquiry, and reclaim the narrative. And we do that as in a strategic way with the strategic response of building capacity and shifting the narrative and opportunity using five key what we call branches. And so one of those is creative facilitation. The second is entrepreneurship. The third branch is service. The fourth is storytelling. And then the fifth is training and education. And so in each of these branches, we're doing this work in response to injustice. And so that can really vary depending on how we're called in. One of the things I do also want to acknowledge is, you know, the name is Ade Project, and a lot of people kind of assume, well, oh, this is just a little project or like a little thing that someone is doing. But the name even is very intentional. Ade is not only an acronym for Artist Designing Evolution, but Ade in Yoruba, which is one of the original African traditions and very intentional connection with our work, is Ade means crown. And so even in, you know, and project is, you know, acknowledging that we're doing this work cooperatively, one project at a time. But we are in it for the long game. And the last thing I'll say is, with all of those different areas or branches of work, oftentimes we do see a lot of cross-pollination, and things can come to us in the way of, sometimes it's been, we've done several art exhibits around social justice issues. We have a couple of permanent art installations here in Asheville that we've project managed. We are currently in a process around a Confederate monument here in Asheville. We've done public education programs for youth. We do panels and film discussions, and just, it can look so many different ways. And that's one of the beautiful things of being rooted in art and creativity, is we're having these difficult conversations and moving the work forward, but also doing it in a way that engages our imagination, which is really important when we're trying to dismantle anything. We have to create the thing and put in its place.
Well, I want to talk to you more about that, particularly the structure. I'm talking to Cortina Janelle Caldwell today on the state of things, organizer and creator of Artist Designing Evolution, Ade. And tell us again what that means in Yoruba.
It means crown.
Crown. So, I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of the cooperative too, because it means you're more closely identified with, you're more integrated in the system. One of the problems with nonprofits is that they, in some ways, sort of have this kind of zombie economics where you think, oh, I'm going to give my money to this thing because that makes my money pure. Then when I invest, I'll put it over here and I can't really watch what's happening to my investments, but I have to worry about my future. And so the zombie goes out in the world and sort of eats flesh, but doesn't really have a soul. On the other hand, your soulful money is given away and you say it's pure because I gave it. What's lovely about this is that you're integrated. You're part of the market machinery, but organized in a non-hierarchical way. Tell me more about the importance of being part of the system in some ways, but also organizing yourself in a non-hierarchical way.
Oh, that's such a great question, Frank. And this has actually been the intersection where I personally have done a lot of learning, right? Because as the founder of this organization, I've been very intentional and sometimes resistant to place myself, to name myself as an executive director, which is a traditional role or title that we see in nonprofits, or, you know, to give myself any sort of additional weight beyond the other people that were working alongside me. That was a struggle because a lot of people were looking for that leadership and that in that particular way that we experience in other organizations where it's like I'm being told what to do and what to think and how to go about my work, as opposed to, you know, being trusted and welcomed for my expertise and my lived experience and trusting myself to that that contribution is okay and enough.
Well,
so
I tell you what,
that has been
I'm going to have to take a break here because I want you to pursue that thought and also talk more about how you got there, the kinds of projects that you're involved in, the kind of impact that you're having and hoping to have, and again, how you got there when my conversation with Cortina Janelle Caldwell continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Cortina Janelle Caldwell today, founder of Artist Designing Evolution, ADE, an organization in Western North Carolina that uses art and creativity to solve big community problems. And we were talking about the fact that it's a cooperative, not a nonprofit, that the way you structure yourself, you're very mindful of that and have to sort of tell yourself every day, what does it mean to be an executive director? Always navigating these very important questions about ownership and voice and whose project, you know, what are the ways of governance for projects like this. Take us inside one project that you've done in Western North Carolina and give us a sense of sort of who are the players, how did it come about, and, you know, and then there's a product. Something comes out in the end. Maybe you can walk us through.
Yeah, sure. And definitely I think this conversation, this piece of it is an important one. What I would say is one comes to mind is the Celebrating African Americans Through Public Art project that was completed last year. And it was really interesting because it was probably one of the first projects that we got contracted for as an organization. And so typically, you know, that how that works is, and some of it has to do with relational capital and social capital, right? Because that's also part of any cooperative is you recognize the value of your relationships. And so as I kind of launched ADE Project, I got tapped for this opportunity with the City of Asheville. Their economic development office had launched into this project a couple years prior, and at the time it was called the Visiting Artist Project. Well, there was a lot of community backlash and some conflict that arose because community members felt as though they were being overlooked and that Asheville was reaching beyond its own community to bring artists in to preserve the history and the stories of the African-American community in Asheville, and that these people had no relationship with the community. Therefore, how could they most authentically represent it? So the City of Asheville completely reworked its plan in hearing community input, engaged on a site visit and a community relationship building process as a beginning of selecting the artist that was going to do this work, and then proceeded to, at the beginning of 2019, decided that they needed to turn this process more fully over to the community, be a support, bring in other community players, and also bring in a project manager. And that's where ADE Project enters in. So over the course of a year, basically from about February to November, I was tasked with kind of course correcting in some ways with the steering committee or the planning committee, which was comprised of many community members, from artists to organizational nonprofit leaders. We had Dr. Darren Waters, a part of our group, which many folks may know, who does a lot of amazing historical work about blacks in Southern Appalachia. Actually just had their sixth or seventh annual conference last week, and we're proud to be a part of that work as well, which I could tell a whole other story about that. But just to kind of wrap this, so, you know, there's a lot of different people at the table, including, you know, developers and other people who had interest in this area of the community that had been selected to do this installation and basically cultural preservation work. And so I had to work very closely with these people on a week-to-week basis and do planning and organizing around engaging local artists to be part of this process, that it wasn't just out of town or visiting artists, to engage the local youth and other sort of art or creative sector players or stakeholders. And so it was a really engaged listening process and planning process. We had several community workshops that we hosted to teach people how to respond to artist statements, as well as to engage youth and community members from the block, from the Black community, to make art with us and see themselves in what would become this permanent installation in Asheville, to mark and remember this historic African-American business and residential district that got largely impacted by a lot of factors, systemically and otherwise, and kind of its disappearance.
Right.
So now there are two installations there that we were able to get installed, and we had a beautiful community unveiling celebration in November.
And, Well, I just want to ask you, because through that, then the objections and the anxieties about the Asheville African-American community, I think, were satisfied through that. And by expanding the scope of what community meant and by listening to all of those voices, people weren't diminished at all. Lines weren't drawn. In fact, the entire what was defined as community simply got bigger, if I'm hearing you right. Is that what happened?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was so, and it was such hard work. I mean, we came up against so many challenges, and I learned and grew so much from that project, and having to, you know, work with out-of-town artists and local artists and developers and contractors. So,
well, I want to take you back. Well, I want to see how what else you've learned along the way and take you back, because I think what you do is you illustrate the value of cooperative capitalism and explain and show how you, first of all, foreground the value of social capital and put that back into the treasury, social capital being caregivers at home, broader communities that you've expanded to, social capital, which is erased by corporate capitalism. So I think one of the things you're doing very well is to foreground and show us what's lost, what we can gain through cooperative capitalism that we lose through corporate capitalism. Take us back to your childhood. How'd you get there? Tell us a little bit about growing up in Morganton.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like my work reflects my upbringing, which was very much being raised in a village. And, I had a teenage, my mom had me when she was 16. She got pregnant with me, so she was a teen mom. On top of being, you know, Black and in a small town, and at that time having even less opportunities than my generation has access to now. And so getting pregnant in high school was monumental in a lot of ways. And it was interesting because that really set the tone for my childhood. My mom had four kids by the time she was 25, which I'm 34, and I can't imagine having four kids at this moment. And you know, there were a lot of sacrifices and a lot of challenges that come with what it means to be poor and Black in the rural South. And, you know, there are just some things that we didn't have and some things, you know, because my mom had gone through her trauma, there are some things that were passed along to my brothers and I, and that we're still working to this day to heal, to do our work around healing and really understanding, okay, well, our childhood wasn't great, and so why was that? And, like, realizing as you step out more into the world maybe how, quote-unquote, abnormal some things are.
Well, and your maternal grandmother played an important part in your upbringing as well. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so she also raised me with my mom. I think, again, being a teen mom, I had my grandmother's hands growing up, and then also many aunts and cousins and so forth. So I was always out in community and in a village being raised. And my grandmother was a big part of that. She was the first Black woman entrepreneur that I knew. She hired me at age 12, and I was relentless in my desperation to get her approval and make her proud. And, you know, my siblings and my cousins didn't make the cut, but I ended up sticking with it because she didn't treat us any different than the adults she had working for her. She had a catering business and did a lot of festivals and events. So I learned a lot from her. And I think it has influenced my entrepreneurship and my beliefs in this intersection of entrepreneurship and community today. I really saw her do it first.
Well, I know your African, indigenous, and Appalachian roots are all central to who you are. When did you become aware of your family's history?
It's interesting because I think sometimes you kind of block certain memories out for different reasons. And what I will say is when I started getting more, more focused on my racial equity journey for myself and unpacking these things, which was probably really intensely about three to five years ago. And at that time, I really felt called to look up my family's lineage and DNA, and I really wanted to know where my ancestors were from, or at least have a sense. And so I'm one of those people who did a DNA test and sent off my vial to come back from the lab. And I've done a couple just to, like, cross-reference, and from what I understand, my ancestors are West African, and Yoruba is one of the cultures of that homeland. And also, that triggered a lot of memories and also some great conversations with my great aunts. So my mother's aunts and uncles, who live in Rutherford County largely, who still had memories of their grandmother, who was my great-great-grandmother, who was a Black and a Cherokee woman. And so, and we have a picture, not many details, but I really feel like that influences my work as well, as learning those stories and that deeper history. Also, one other cool fun fact that I'll share is, and this memory came flooding back to me when I got my DNA results as well, is when I was about 11 years old, I was at we usually go to Forest City for Christmas or for Thanksgiving or both as a family. And one time we were down there having dinner, and I was outside playing with my cousins, and this realized that this museum had just moved in across the street. It was these old apartments they renovated, and they turned it into an African American history museum. And we were playing and decided to go across the street. Walked in the museum, and there was this regal Black woman that greeted us, and I was like, wow, she just seems like she knows all the secrets about the world. And she asked her what we were there for, and we wanted to look through the books. And so we looked through the genealogy books of Rutherford County and saw our family's name in this book, and our family name is Lynch, which also is probably so packed with so much meaning. And so it was so interesting and kind of a little scary, actually, at the time, as an 11-year-old to, like, have a name in your family, and then you open a book and it's right there. I was like, what does that even mean? But I realize now that really kind of planted this seed of curiosity that I just hadn't picked back up until now.
Well, and you did pretty well in school, right? You were doing very well, and you liked school. Am I right about that?
Yeah, school was my happy place. I actually got in trouble a lot. At first in elementary, I got in trouble for laughing too much. And then in high school, I won Best Laugh Award. So very contrasting school experience.
You did well. So what kind of messages were you getting from your community about your future?
Yeah, well, I was also going to say my teachers and some of my guidance counselors and just different people in my life, I really feel like, were guardian angels in some way. And I mentioned having this village childhood rearing, and I can appreciate that now. At the time, it felt like I was being shuffled around a lot, but now I really appreciate all the wisdom that I was getting. And my teachers always saw that I was bright, and I was a super happy kid when I was in school because I loved to learn. I was always winning awards for the most books read in elementary school, and then spelling bees and all that kind of stuff. And then I was super involved in clubs and all that. Eventually, I joined this program called Educational Talent Search, which really opened the door for me to dream about college. We went on a lot of college tours, and I started going to enrichment camps starting in middle school, all through high school. I went away every summer and went on college tours, and that just opened me up to more was possible for me than my small town.
When you thought, as you did that, as you thought about what was possible for you, what were you imagining for your future?
Well, it was interesting because I had kind of gotten talked into the practical route, right? Like, I had gotten kind of laughed out of the room when I came home and said that I wanted to be an architect because it just was not something that you heard people say. I literally was told, you don't know any black architects. What are you talking about? You need to be a lawyer or a doctor or, you know, something practical. And I did. Like, I knew I wanted to help people, and so I chose a more practical route. But then eventually I had to get real with myself and have this real cathartic moment where I was, like, in college and I had done the thing and I had gotten the full ride. I was awarded a Gates Millennium Scholarship, which was 1 in 1,000. And I think only one other person in Burke County's history had been awarded the recognition. And so that was kind of a big deal. And then I went off to college and was flailing around and spent a lot of time as a pre-nursing major, and then realized that I just did not want to be somebody else's version of me, and I wasn't really happy in healthcare. Changed my major to social work for about a year, and then that's when I took my personal leave to really kind of go work and ask some hard questions and just take a breather and really figure out what I wanted to do before I had this piece of paper that, like, locked me into something.
Talking to Cortina Janelle Caldwell today on The State of Things. So as you said, you took that break and you tried to figure out who you really were. At some point, you identified as you do now identify as queer. When did that part of yourself make itself known to you?
I think I always kind of knew in some way. I mean, in middle school, it became more my awareness that I wasn't having the same interest in boys that my friends were. And I had a lot of, like, I actually hung out with guys as well a lot in elementary and middle school, and I didn't see a lot of my other female friends doing that. And so I was always kind of just, like, odd and, like, just didn't really subscribe to cliques, but just really got along with a lot of different kinds of people. So that stood out to me. And I think, I guess what would now be called today, you know, if I was as bold as the middle schoolers of today, you know, I would acknowledge that I had a, you know, girlfriend, quote unquote, in middle school. We were really close, and you know, we just knew that there were certain things that we couldn't do or couldn't talk about with other people. And just even that awareness lets you know that A, I probably am different, and B, the world does not want me to be this thing or will accept me for this. So,
well, the world,
Well,
I was going to say the world, and in particular the church, and the church was important to you. How was all of that? How were you reconciling yourself with all of that?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say the church was important to me. I will say my relationship with God and spirituality has always been very important to me. I've always felt myself really connected to something bigger than me. And in fact, when I was younger, it was so surreal because I definitely had these moments where I felt like I had just been dropped off and I was like, oh my God, I don't belong here. And I just felt, you know, often alone in my thoughts and my way of being. And I think queerness was one of those, but also just really finding God connection to things and not really needing it to be in a church. I think some of that was informed by my mom's non-subscription to any religion or spirituality. She didn't go to church, and I wouldn't consider her to be an atheist, but she didn't press it. It really came from my grandparents.
And then this was also part of this this taking time off and coming to yourself and letting yourself come to you. What was going through your mind at the time that you decided to make the break? And we're coming up against a break here, too. So I'll ask you to give us the preview, and then we'll take a break and come back and get more. But talk about what was happening to you at UNCG that caused you to think, I got to stop this.
I had to really face my demons, if I'm being honest. You know, I really had some difficult moments growing up. And I know that my story isn't abnormal. As I've talked more about some of the things that I've experienced and what I've had to heal from, you know, I think some of that has to do with the kind of relationship with my mom that I always kind of yearned for but didn't have because of what she had to do in order to provide what she could for us. Like, it really meant that she wasn't around a lot, working 2 to 3 jobs. And I had a lot of anger and resentment about that. And I also felt robbed of my childhood in some ways, because I did have to be a kind of mom to my brothers at like 10, maybe. And I think also really saying out loud and doing some healing with my own body. I had been sexually assaulted growing up, and I hadn't told anybody yet. And in college was the first time that I could really sit with some quiet and think for myself for once, and everything came flooding in. And even some other memories of traumas and, you know, experiences with domestic violence that gave me nightmares for a long time. And, you know, it's really been super recent that I've not had those nightmares, but I think all of those things and just not having anybody to talk to, and I enrolled myself in therapy for the first time.
Well, I tell you what, we will talk about where that dark night of the soul led Cortina Janelle Caldwell when my conversation continues on the state of things after this. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Cortina Janelle Caldwell today on The State of Things, talking about her program and project called Artist Designing Evolution and how she got there. Cortina, before the break, you talked about the fact that you recognized while you were going to UNCG, you were looking into the healthcare field and decided you had to turn around and face some of the trauma and begin some of the healing that you knew needed to take place. It's one thing to say, I need to stop this. On the other hand, so walking away from what you were doing makes perfect sense. What did you walk toward?
Yeah, wow, that's a great question. So, you know, one of the hard things I will say about making that shift of, like, what am I walking toward as I face these things, I, you know, really had a newfound appreciation for counseling and therapy. I did end up having to, that after I took a personal leave from UNC Greensboro because it was on campus. But then it gave me the opportunity to continue along with some practices that she had provided for me. I had an amazing first experience with therapy and counseling and really was fortunate in that way. And she provided not only talk therapy, but also some hands-on exercises or give me books or activities and things. So that was really helpful for me because I'm a very kinesthetic learner. And so I kind of continued looking for that when I left for that, you know, for that break. And I picked up The Artist Way by Julia Cameron. I think a lot of people are probably familiar with that work. And that was really, really beautifully unraveling for me in all the right ways. And then after that, I continued to pick up the next process or exercise and kind of dug my way out of the hole slowly. It's been, and honestly, I would say since that moment of counseling up until now, and I just realized this the other day, that it's been about a very concentrated, maybe 15-year journey so far, from that moment when I first started getting counseling until now. And so it's not been a quick process by any means, you know, and I think that's one of the things that I like to remind people when they see a day project and they see this bright, shiny thing and they think, oh, you know, well, why her or why are you getting all this success? Because that's definitely come up in my community in some ways in the past. And that's also a challenging thing. But I remind people that sometimes you don't know how long, like you said before the break, the dark night of the soul, you don't know what somebody's journey is and how long it actually took until we see the fruit of all of that hard work that had to happen and pulling all those weeds. So,
well, I'm guessing listening to you that you also believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but just listening to you now, you probably believe that journey continues. It ain't over yet.
Yeah, no, lifelong. Yeah. But I get a little wiser every day.
A little wiser every day. So I'm going to hear some more about some of the steps along the way, because you left UNCG, but you did go back to school and you went to Liberty University. Tell us more about the choice to go there, because some people will know this is associated with the Reverend Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, his son. We know those stories. So we know what that place is at least associated with, I think. And I have to say, I'm a bit surprised. Tell me about that decision.
I laugh because I get that response from a lot of people. And it's so interesting because that's basically the story of my life with my decisions and things. I've all, I you know, one of the things that I'll say about my decision to go to Liberty is I'm such a seeker, and I know this also to be true because I'm a life path seven for people that are interested or, you know, into numerology. And so I truly, truly am a seeker of knowledge, and I really need to know what I know. And so, you know, one of the things that I also knew is that I wanted to finish my degree. I really grappled with that for a long time because I could have just stayed working. I had a really successful career. Once I left UNCG, I, you know, worked my way up in hospitality, started working for Clayton Weaver Restaurants and Hotels in Greensboro, and then got scouted and started working for Washington Dugan in Durham, and could have really been more increasingly successful. And eventually I did end up working at the Grove Park Inn Resort and Spa in Nashville, and that was kind of my last hurrah, if you will. And I think one of the things that I also realized was, okay, but if I don't get this degree or don't finish school, I won't feel great about that. Mm. It's not about what other people say. I need to feel like I completed what I set out to do. So one of the things I also knew to be true was I, you know, as the case for many Black undergraduate students, we don't often have those resources or support from family members to tap back into when we're off at school. And that can be very draining on mental health, emotional, financial, all these things that are additional stressors on top of trying to get the grade. And I really was in a position, a hard position, because at the time that I was at UNC Greensboro, I needed to work and earn extra money in order to take care of some of the other things that, like, my bare bones scholarship didn't take care of. But that I found that challenging to do because I was required to be in class, physically in class, during the day, almost 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. And so taking a personal leave from school was also like, there's got to be a different way for me to do this. And so all of that to say, I ended up, after about a year and kind of like working my way through the hospitality industry, I was like, I need to go back and get this degree. And I found out about Liberty as I was doing a search for online programs that would accept transfer credits, because at this point I had so many credits. I was like, I need these to do something. And so I ended up doing some research, and also was really keen on, I needed to know for myself whether or not I was Christian. Mm. And the only way I was going to reconcile that for myself, because of what I had been told growing up, but then always feeling really rejected by Christianity because I knew that I was at least lesbian or queer or whatever label I would land on, I knew that I was told that I wasn't welcome in the kingdom of heaven, right? So there were these conflicting truths. So it was like me going to Liberty was this opportunity to grapple face first with, am I Christian? Do I believe this? How can I be this and also be myself, and just needing those answers. And then also just being very impressed by their online education program, wow, which remains to be very robust program. Got my bachelor's. I actually triple majored in business, education, and social science, and then went on to get my master's with them. I have a master's of arts in management and leadership, which I was really grateful for. It was a sister program to an MBA. I didn't get a MBA. I was like,
you're breaking up a little bit. I'm sorry, you're breaking up. So, but you got your MBA. So, it's a triple major undergrad. You get an MBA. Did you get any other postgrad degrees from there? MBA?
Not from Liberty. Yeah, I didn't end up getting. It's not an MBA. It's a sister program to MBA. It's called. I got a Master's of Arts in Management and Leadership.
Right. But I mean, the point is, you were. Oh, go ahead. Now here I'm cutting you off again. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was also. No, it's okay. I was just going to say I also later ended up getting certified in facilitation, but that came later in my journey after Liberty. But yeah.
You were all in. You were all in at Liberty. And as you say, so the education you thought was good. You liked that. You liked the course offerings. And you felt, mm-hmm, clearly it kept going. Now, what about the other part of this journey, which was to say, you know, am I a Christian? Was that resolved for you?
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is it didn't make sense for me logically or even spiritually to hitch myself to a belief system that also rejected me. Mm-hmm. Like that just couldn't, I just couldn't make it make sense in my head, and I still can't. And that's not to say anything negative about Christianity at all. You know, I have friends that are all kinds of religious, spiritual walks of life, and I love that because we have some really interesting conversations and we can coexist. I just think that for me, I could not, you know, subscribe to the practices. Like, I really need to be, like, as you say, I need to be all in, and I need to know that I really align with something. And I think that that's probably true for most of my millennial generation. And that's just a really core value for me is authenticity. And do I feel a sense of connection and belonging here? And I didn't feel that sense of belonging within Christianity for my identity and my personal beliefs.
What about now? Is there a practice that you, a spiritual practice that you feel yourself identified with and that you do? Or do you do a practice?
I do. I consider myself to be a spiritual person. As I said, I have a strong connection with God. I believe that God is. And there's like probably a whole other conversation that we could have about spirituality and spiritual activism, because I really consider myself at the core, you know, the reason why I do what I do is really about spiritual activism and reconciling inhumane treatment, because we, you know, it's inhumane. Like, right. You know, it's an attack against our humanity. And what? So I have that practice. It's an everyday practice. It's a living life practice. It's being a good person. It's having values and integrity. And I think it's also, you know, finding that alignment with my own cultural traditions and practicing that.
And you talked about moving around a little bit, working in hotels in Greensboro and working in Durham as well. Went back to Western North Carolina. Why did you move back to Western North Carolina?
Well, I moved back in 2011, and I honestly, it was that moment again of reconciling and finally being like, okay, you know, if I'm going to move forward in my life, I need to be fully myself, because that's if I don't, it's not actually living. And if I'm going to live, I'm going to live. And I remember having this very intense conversation with myself and really making the decision to move back, and really longing for the mountains and longing for something different than the landscape out in the triangle. And I love those places dearly. And I just was like, these aren't the places for me long term. And I really felt called to do my work and to start my work back home, and I needed to do that first. So, yeah, I moved back in 2011, first to Morganton, was there. Lived with my grandmother for 3 months, which was really actually healing and beautiful, challenging at some moments, but it was great. And started the process of coming out to my family, which was really important to me, and starting the next chapter. And then I moved to Asheville that fall and have been in Asheville ever since.
Talking to Cortina Janelle Caldwell today on The State of Things. Founder and creative community organizer for Artists Designing Evolution. So talk about when that idea occurred to you and how it formed, because I know that's not the first thing you did, right? You had a tour business. When did this idea become a vision for you?
Yes. I think it really was the depth. Like, I kind of consider my journey, or like maybe all of our journeys, kind of like this onion, and you peel back layers, and maybe it's going to make you cry and shed some tears along the way, but you eventually get to the core of the thing. And I think that's kind of what it was. I was constantly pulling back the layers and being like, oh, what's in this layer? What can I learn from this? How can I grow? What needs to be, you know, dead or released or what have you. And then, so I guess once I moved to Asheville, I was really keen that I wanted to start a business. And I had enough of the tourism and the hospitality industry that I was like, wow, I really can make a difference here in finding these deeper connections between these mega, mega million dollar resorts and establishments and destinations and them sustaining community, because that's what people are coming to visit these places for anyway, is the cultural aspects and whatever artistic or creative or experiential aspects of the community they can bring or they can experience while they're there. And so I saw that gap that it to me seemed like a responsibility for the hospitality and tourism industry to give back to communities. And so started a tourism product company and was very successful with that, winning several recognitions of the model, and dissolved and kind of gave pieces of that away, and more intently started in 2015 on this path that really culminated into Artist Design and Evolution over a period of 3 years of some very intentional work around what builds community and what creates resilience and creativity and all these things, because I had already been exposed to the cultural fabric.
Yeah, what's interesting about it is, too, that you, when you involve the community and there's actual, you know, proceeds to be shared and to be distributed through the cooperative, again, rather than sort of create a brand, which is a lot of what's going on now, marketing the place, marketing the community, is, you know, in the sort of the public relations advertising that goes out for tourism. This is saying, yeah, but we're also going to benefit by this, benefit by more than just having jobs. We're going to create that community, make sure the proceeds go back. So it's a fascinating thought. Tell us about, I know you've got an event coming up this Friday called Black Star Seed, and I've only given you about a minute, but give us a sense of what that is.
Sure. Black Star Seed is a gathering of communities of all kinds of walks of life to really hear from and to really sit with us in a moment of reimagination with healers and future keepers and artists and entrepreneurs, and these are all Black women, and it was very intentional to have these stories uplifted by those that have often been most silenced in communities, and to really do this healing work together by sharing our stories. And so we invite you to come and sit with us in our virtual living room. We'll be streaming on YouTube. And all are welcome. And if I can mention a link, I don't know if I'm able to,
sure,
where people can go to find out. Yeah. So a really easy way to find out more information or to grab a seat for that or to donate to support our artist cause, Black artist cause, you can go to The Ade Project, which is adeproject.org/artists. And at the top of the page, you'll see information there.
We'll link to that at our website, stateofthings.org, as well. So if you missed that, go to stateofthings.org, and we'll get you a link and hook you up. Cortina Janelle Caldwell, founder and creative community organizer of Artist Designing Evolution, the Ade Project. Thank you so much for being with us, Cortina. Great to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Have a good one.
Thank you. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikam Dodor is our intern, Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Budarsky also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.